You are about to enter a world beyond your five senses. A world where doubt and certainty walk hand in hand. A world where strangeness is king and mystery is his bastard child. You are about to enter Lionel Nimrod's inexplicable world. A poet once proclaimed, "The sea shall bring about a sea change, changing things." I'm Lionel Nimrod. It was when I was recreating the epic voyage of my hero, the second century Belgian fisherman, Flavy Thompson, for Channel 4, that I first experienced that mysterious energy that dwells within the sea. Suddenly, from somewhere in the depths, huge phantom waves began to batter at my dinghy, as if under the influence of some mysterious force. What awesome power creates such waves? What is hidden in the undersea? Join me, if you dare, in this, my inexplicable world.
Lionel Nimrod's Inexplicable World of the Sea! And please welcome your ticket collectors on the bus of embarrassment.
I'm Stuart Lee.
And the name I use is Richard Herring.
Hello and welcome to another Inexplicable World, coming from the Stanley Theatre at Liverpool University.
Today we're looking at the sea. It's the home to an infinite variety of weird and wonderful life forms. It served as the inspiration for poets, artists and lovers. And its huge, empty expanses make it the ideal dumping ground for 4 billion tons of British sewage every day.
The sea covers 93% of the Earth's surface, has an estimated volume of over 20 gallons, and if you were to throw a coin into its deepest part, the Marianas Trench, you'd be unlikely to find it again.
According to Jules Verne, there are 20,000 leagues under the sea, which puts our own four major domestic football leagues into some sort of perspective.
Every year, hundreds of British people cover themselves from head to foot in grease and try to swim the English Channel. It's time they were told that there are ferries leaving every English port four times an hour, where they have warm drinks, orange seats, soft beds, and covering yourself in grease is actively frowned upon.
Tonight we will finally answer all the mysteries of the sea, like what did the sperm whale have to do to get its name?
And why, when there are seas called the Red Sea, the Black Sea and the Yellow Sea, is there no sea called the sort of bluey-green sort of sea? Or in the case of Britain, the Brown Sea?
Tonight we've come to Liverpool to find out. And Liverpool's Albert Dock was, of course, once a huge and thriving shipbuilding industry until it was cruelly closed down by Richard Madeley and Judy Finnegan of this morning to make way for Fred Talbot's floating weather map. And we're also here because the Stanley Theatre is almost unique in the theatre world as it is encased in a glass dome and is situated underwater deep in the sea off Liverpool's coast.
But what is the sea made of? Who should know better than our first guest, Fish, from Marillion?
Down in the meadow, in a little bitty pool, swam three little fishes.
Hello, if I could just pick you up on one thing. I'm not actually with Marillion anymore. I've got my own solo career.
Oh, I'm sorry, Fish, I hadn't noticed. Is it going well?
Yes.
Good, well, what we want you to do, Fish, is to swim through the sea round the theatre, filtering the seawater through your gills, and then tell us, in your opinion, what the composition of seawater is.
Just one more thing. I'm not really actually a fish. Fish is just my pop name. My real name's Derek Dick.
I'm sorry, our researcher Russell must have made some mistake. Sorry to waste your time, Mr. Dick.
And look, coincidentally, I haven't actually got a gig on tonight, so I could do it for you anyway if you want. Is it cash in hand?
Well, we could give you a fiver.
Six?
No, five.
Oh, all right.
Right, Derek, through this porthole and drink the sea.
Can I just sing a bit from a 1990 album, Virgil in a Wilderness of Mirrors?
No.
Now, throughout the show, we plan to use the fortuitous location of the Stanley Theatre to see if any undiscovered sea creatures lie hidden in the sea. We've literally filled the sea around the theatre with things we imagine undiscovered fish and sea creatures would like to eat.
Plankton, weeds, worms and flies on hooks, thousands of flakes of flaky fish food, and 24 noisy, splashing teenage American disaster movie actors.
In my attempt to attract things that live in the sea, I've set up this powerful sonic ray beaming out sound at too high a frequency for human ears to hear. It's in honour of Dave Dickinson and all of the Liverpool University Science Fiction Society. Dave and his friend will be only too well aware that in Doctor Who and the Sea Devils, the Master uses a similar sonic ray, and then these frog men come out of the sea to do his every bidding.
So the experiment has begun.
The high-frequency sonic ray isn't working so well. We seem to have attracted a large number of bats and dogs, which have tried unsuccessfully and rather tragically to swim down to the theatre.
And an elderly woman from Tunbridge Wells is also circling the theatre. She seems to be trying to speak to us.
What's that awful noise? I'm calling the police.
Yeah, they can hear when they want to, can't they, as old people? Ask them to move along on the bus and they act all deaf, but play them a sound too high for the human ear to pick up, and they manage to hear it well enough to come round and complain.
Sea lore is notoriously mysterious, and sea dog sailors are notoriously salty, which is why you should never, under any circumstances, lick one. Our oceans have been responsible for many mysterious disappearances. The crew of the Mary Celeste, Glenn Miller's plane, entire armadas of sailing ships, and one of my flip-flops.
But most marine disappearances occur in the Bermuda Triangle. There have been many controversial theories as to what it is there that makes ships and planes disappear around Bermuda. But the most controversial hypothesis has to be this one. Thesis of frilly-shirted crooner Barry Manilow, which overturned all accepted scientific thinking when first put forward in 1981. Is the Bermuda Triangle, as Manilow believes, very bad? Or is it just quite bad?
Oceanographer Dr. Maureen Ewing has spent the last 20 years attempting to solve its mysteries.
Ships, planes and people don't just disappear. There is always a rational, factual, credible scientific explanation to all the Triangle's mysteries. I believe all the vessels in question are not missing, but simply mislaid. For example, last year, I discovered the crew of the deserted Rosalie vessel on the top deck of a London bus under one of the seats in a plastic bag, where the absent-minded captain had left them. And last month, I found the ship, the Star Ariel, and all its crew, which disappeared in 1949, down the back of a sofa.
Thank you, Maureen. And tonight, I think I may finally be able to explain the age-old mystery of the deserted Mary Celeste. Do you remember, Stu, that night when you were driving us back from Exeter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we both had about 8 or 9 pints.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then you stopped on the hard shoulder for us to go to the toilet and be sick. Do you remember?
Yeah.
When we came back from over the bank, we couldn't remember where we'd left the car. So we slept under a motorway bridge.
Yeah, all right, Rich, just forget
but, you know,
about
and then the next day, the next day, the papers were full of the story of the mysterious M4 Tan Morris Marina mystery. An empty tan Morris Marina with funny cigarettes burning in the ashtray and half-drunk cans of lager and your partly read magazine on the dashboard was discovered when a police car crashed into it. They assumed the occupants had just sort of mysteriously vanished.
Right, just forget about it.
I tried to phone the police, remember, to tell them it was your car, but you said there was no need and ripped the phone out of the wall.
Now, Britain is famed worldwide as the best seafaring nation. No one dare deny that Britannia rules the waves. And ruling the waves more than makes up for no longer ruling America, Africa, Asia or France. At least we rule the waves.
And one of the men who helped us to establish our iron fist of dominance was Viscount Horatio Nelson, as this 1970s documentary from Blue Peter reveals.
Viscount Horatio Nelson was born in a pauper's hospital in 1758.
All right, push, my love, push. That's it, mate. There we go. Oh, very lovely. There you go, Mrs. Nelson. A lovely little boy.
Oh, is he all right?
Well, he's only got one arm and one eye, I'm afraid.
Oh, I don't care about that. He's my son. I love him.
Oh, and he's got a 100-foot column growing out his feet. Which explains the difficult birth.
100-foot column? Oh, get the freak out of here!
Motherless and deformed, young Nelson was cruelly taunted at his school.
Motherless, 100-foot column freak! Motherless, 100-foot column freak!
I'm sorry, you'll have to speak out!
We said...
Motherless, 100-foot column freak!
One day I'll show them!
As a young man, things went from bad to worse. No proper young lady of the day would want to be seen with a man with such an enormous column as Nelson. Nelson went down to the docks intent on ending it all. As he hopped towards the sea, aboard a Navy frigate, something happened which was to change his life.
Damn your eyes, cabin boy! Your over-enthusiastic cleaning has broken our mast clean off!
I'm sorry, I didn't think.
However on earth shall we sail to sea now?
Well, we could ask the gentleman with the column to act as a sort of makeshift mast, which will no doubt lead to him becoming an admiral and a national hero of some sort, I shouldn't wonder.
Pipe down, ignorant whelp! Hello, you, sir, are with the column.
But the cabin boy was right. Nelson rose right up the navy from a mast to an admiral until his greatest day at the Battle of Trafalgar.
Sir, the Admiralty are sending the signal to retreat.
What's that? What you say? Something to eat? You've just had breakfast. Get on with the battle.
Yes, yes, sir. But the French are overpowering us.
Yes, they do stink a bit, don't they? There's only one thing for it. We'll have to give them a bit of a bath.
Look at that, cabin boy. Viscount Horatio Nelson is using his column to maneuver through the water so that he can sink the French ships with a sword. Amazing.
Yeah, I shouldn't wonder if we don't now win the Battle of Trafalgar, but Nelson is mortally wounded in his hour of bravery.
Shut up. You're really spoiling this.
Told you.
It's over. Kiss me, Hardy.
Yes, sir.
And Hardy, kiss my column.
You'll have to, sir.
And so Mad King George personally constructed a statue in honour of Nelson and his column in the heart of London, so that none may forget. Now, any English child being taunted for having a column growing out of any part of their body need only say, "Ah, but look at Lord Nelson."
But what is the strange attraction that draws writers and artists to the sea? In his autobiography, 1851, the painter Turner wrote,
"As an artist, the sea has always been my favoured subject because of my romantic concern for men and nature, and because the sea is really, really easy to paint. Once you've learned how to draw water, which is only scribble, that's all there is. I can't do faces for toffee. Hands just come out looking like bananas."
Let's see how Derek Dick has got on in his underwater sea-drinking activities.
Hello again. Yes, I drunk nearly 10 gallons of seawater out there, and according to the reactions of my taste buds and intestines, I would say that the sea is 17% salt, 40% industrial and organic sewage, 3% hair, 15% kittens, which were just for Christmas, 14% sparkling Vimto, a soft drink so unpleasant that nearly all of it that's made is immediately flushed down a toilet, 7% a sort of rubbery, transparent tube thing full of glue, I don't know what they were, they kind of tasted a bit strange, and 2% water. There also seemed to be rather a lot of flaky fish food and worms and bats and an old dead woman from Tunbridge Wells. So that's it. And now I'd like to sing a track from a 1990 solo album, Vigil in a Wilderness of Mirrors.
I'm sorry, Fish, there's no time for that. But here's your fiver, off you go, goodbye.
All right, goodbye then, I'll just sit here.
One remarkable undersea creature is the sea urchin. Earlier this year, the Australian divers Rod and Jane Taylor went in search of the hidden underwater nest of the sea urchins of the English Channel.
Here we are, thousands of feet beneath the waves and rounding our first coral bank. Any minute now, we should catch sight of our first sea urchin.
Hey, there's one over there.
Good morning, Governor.
Ooh,
and you've got a lovely lady by your side this fine day.
Watch out, Jane, the sea urchin's stealing your goggles.
Nah, we wouldn't steal your goggles, lady. You and your fancy gent are our friends. Consider yourself. Consider yourself one of the family. There isn't a lot.
Yes, this is one of the largest sea urchin communities. What? 20 to 30 chirpy, cockney, homeless, orphan Victorian boys and girls living thousands of feet below the surface, as Jack Wilde, the so-called artful urchin, explained.
Yeah, it was in 1841 that Sir Robert Peel decided to deal with the problem of London's homeless children by flushing us all down his toilet. We bred in the sewers and then floated out into the sea with the sewage, where we've survived ever since.
But you know, Miss Taylor,
As we sit here at the bottom of the sea, without a mother to care for us, there's one question we always end up asking ourselves. Where is love? Does it fall from skies?
But the urchin's sad undersea lives have been changed drastically by the recent arrival of a new occupant in their undersea kingdom.
My boys, what have you got for me today?
Just more flip-flops, Mr. Maxwell. And a towel.
Never mind, urchins. These'll fetch a pretty penny at some seaside souvenir shop because, you know, you've got to pick a pocket or two.
Money doesn't grow on trees. You've got to pick a pocket or two.
And it's a sad indictment of 90s Tory Britain that orphan children are forced to live under the sea, stealing to survive. And until the... Where's my bikini?
But not all the sea animals are as friendly and welcoming as the cheeky sea urchins. Herman Melville's Moby Dick details the destructive power of a giant white whale which bit the leg off of Captain Ahab. And in the early 1980s, animal magic presenter Terry Nutkins had the little finger of his left hand literally bitten off by a vicious white otter.
Nutkins was left psychologically traumatised and with a false wooden finger. He subsequently retired from children's broadcasting to devote his life to sailing the seas of the earth in search of revenge on the wicked otter. And we've got a live link-up with Terry Nutkins now. Mr. Nutkins?
Call me Terry!
Terry, surely you're unlikely to catch the otter which did this to you.
No, Stuart, I will! For I, Terry Nutkins of Animal Magic, will not rest from my divine mission until every otter in the world lies dead and rotted.
Look, this is a bit over the top, isn't it, Terry? It was just your little finger, and you are meant to be a friend to all wildlife.
Not otters, Richard!
You know, I used to really like you on Animal Magic, Terry. Sure, you had a stupid haircut and an odd taste in tight jeans, but I really thought you cared for all God's creatures.
Captain Nutkins, otter on the starboard bow!
Load the harpoons, set the torpedoes, it must die! Die, you hear?
Oh dear, Terry Nutkins there. Well, Terry clearly doesn't realise that the creatures of the sea should be respected, as the Coleridge poem, The Ancient Mariner, shows us. And the Ancient Mariner and his albatross are here in the studio tonight.
Hello, Stuart, thank you for having me along, and me albatross.
First of all, Ancient Mariner, could I just ask you, how old are you exactly?
I'm 29, Stuart.
Well, that's not very ancient, is it?
Well, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Then it's more ancient than you, isn't it? If you were 16, say, you'd think I was really ancient. Most people are married by the time they're 29.
But tell me, Mr. Mariner, why have you got this putrid, stinking albatross corpse around your neck?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, Stuart. You know I am. You see, I shot the lucky albatross at sea for absolutely no reason. And as punishment, the other sailors hung it around my neck for all way to teach me to love all sea animals.
And have you learnt your lesson?
Yes. And now I take my albatross around local primary schools, teaching others that the creatures of the sea are just like you and me. Don't I, Albie?
Yes, you do, Mr. Mariner.
Because killing sea creatures is wrong, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Shall we do our little song, Albie?
Okay. I'd like to fly right up in the sky, but I can't.
You can.
I can't.
You can. I can't. You bloody shot me with a crossbow.
Oh, yes, I did, didn't I? That was very wrong of me. I'm a very bad man. See, that's what we do, Stuart.
Right, and does this act that you do with the skeleton get the message through to the children?
Well, it seems to, Stuart. They all look very scared and cry and run away shouting, "Take the horrible man out of here, he's horrid!" You see, they know what I did was wrong.
Not as wrong as where you got your hand now, Mr. Mariner.
Cool, cheeky.
Thank you, the Ancient Mariner.
For years, people have tried to stop the cruel Japanese race from hunting whales with trade sanctions and environmental group pressure. Have they not learned that the only way to stop the Japanese is by a surprise nuclear attack on one of their major cities?
But Perhaps the wily Japanese are right to be suspicious of whales and their kind, Rich. In October 1983, oceanographer and naturalist Philip Fry befriended a community of dolphins in the Irish Sea with the aim of studying their language. But 2 months later, he disappeared. In February 1984, the British government received this tape, which was washed ashore at Brighton in a bottle.
Hello, it's me, Philip Fry. The dolphins, which I trusted so, have betrayed me. They welcomed me into their community, only to kidnap me. They have me imprisoned somewhere deep beneath the sea. Yes, yes, yes. I will read your statement. Don't hurt me. I, Philip Fry, will not be released until your government releases its hostages. Salty the Seal from Dudley Zoo. Finny the Shark from the Aquaworld theme park in Telford. Bubbles the Blue Whale from Brighton Aquarium. And all our brother fish that have mysteriously disappeared from the sea over the last 200 to 300 years. Please, help me.
The British government refused to help, saying they would simply not do deals with fish because they do not speak the same language.
The second tape from Fry's undersea prison did nothing to soften the government's attitude.
Please, please, help me. I am now housed in the whale's underwater theme park. Land world. I have my own 6 foot square glass tank full of air. I must entertain the visiting aquatic mammal families. They seem to be impressed when they see me walking around, and the keepers make me do forward rolls and handstands. Yes, yes, don't hurt me. Just throw up the meat pie and I'll jump in the air and catch it. Oh, I've missed. Now I'll be punished. Oh, sorry. The dolphins hurt me all the time. Only one of them was friendly to me, my old keeper, Mr. He used to take me out swimming with them, but he was sent away when one of the other dolphins saw him hanging on to a certain part of my anatomy. He was only doing it to guide him, I'm sure. They didn't believe him. Please, please, save me.
But the story has a happy ending, for just last month, one final tape came on the tide. With glad news.
Hello, landmen. It is I, Philip Fry. My ordeal is over. My shows at Landworld and my ability to hop through a hoop and eat a chip dangling from a string has made me the talk of the undersea world. I now have my own half-hour whale TV show in which I play Leggy, the intelligent human pet of a young dolphin. It's very popular.
They call him Flipper.
Quickly, quickly, follow me. Yes, you're right. I do want you to follow me. Old Mrs. has been hit in the shoulder with a harpoon. Yes, that's what I said.
And before we look outside to see what our flaky fish food has revealed, we need just one more piece of information. And if we prize open this giant clamshell, then I think there'll be a surprise inside.
That's right. And as his organ rises like Venus from the waves, it's time for our weekly Peter Fenn's Hammond Organ Believe It or Not file.
Yes, thanks. Believe it or not, if you were sunbathing by the Sea of Tranquility, you wouldn't be having a very tranquil time. Because the Sea of Tranquility is on the moon. And consequently, your unprotected body would be horrifically burnt by the sun's unshielded rays. And then implode through lack of oxygen and disappear deep into the dark void of space.
Thank you, Peter.
No, thank you for having me on again, Richard.
The pleasure's all ours.
You're very kind.
And what was the Hammond organ tune this week?
That Latin number was aptly entitled Spanish Eyes.
By?
Latin numbers don't come easy, and that beautiful melody, like our old favourite Viva España, took 3 Spaniards to pen it. They were Signors Singleton, Snyder and Kempfert. I don't know about Spanish eyes, Richard, but that tune was certainly pleasing on my British ears.
Well, thanks, Peter. Now, looking outside, our sonic flaky fish food experiment doesn't seem to be too much of a success.
Yes, far from attracting all the world's sea creatures. We've actually only got here about 19 fishes, 4 prawns, a jellyfish, and a flip-flop. So, for the first time in the history of the show, I don't think we'll be able to answer the question.
Hey, wait, just one moment.
Fish, Derek Dick, I thought I told you to go, mate.
Yeah, but it's lucky I didn't, because I can help you. I was lying earlier, you see, to trick you. I am really a fish.
You are?
Yes, this outer shell of a hairy Scottish progressive rock singer
is just a shell.
Derek Dick, you are a fish.
Of course Derek Dick isn't a real name. I deliberately chose it as an ironic joke. But I am able to help you with your quest by doing the one thing that will attract all sea animals to this point.
Great, thanks.
But it'll cost you.
Well, we'll give you £5, Derek.
£10,000.
£5.
All right. All I need to do is sing a track from a 1990 solo album, Vigil in a Wilderness of Mirrors.
Listen to me.
Look, it's working. Just creatures are arriving from miles around. Look, a sea urchin, a sea devil, Robert Maxwell. All the sea's secrets are revealed.
Oh no, all the sea's beings are pressing against the glass dome of the theatre. They want to get in and meet their hero, Derek Dick.
Look, it's cracking. We're all going to die.
Shut up singing, Derek. You're going to doom us all. Phew. We were lucky to grab onto this plank, eh, Stu?
Yes, Rich. All the audience must be dead.
No, look. They managed to grab onto that plank there. Hello.
Hello.
So, we now know what lies hidden under the sea. A variety of creatures from beyond our imaginations with a keen interest in third-generation progressive rock, which copies early Genesis before all the good ones left.
Yeah, very interesting, but we've got no food. But I have got a knife, and me and the audience have drawn lots, and we've decided that you must sacrifice yourself so that we can feast on your fat Somerset body.
But Liverpool's just over there, Stu, and the rescue boat's speeding towards us.
Yeah, I know, but we're going to do it anyway.
All right. Goodbye, listeners.
Goodbye.
Ow.
Our journey of discovery ends and reveals what the putrid blue oceans hide beneath their filthy waves. My own journey in Flabby's dinghy, the Ick, ended not on palm-fringed shores, but in the intensive care unit of Dover Hospital. And although my journey floundered, my battle with the sea led me, like Flabby, to discover a new land after all. A land I call myself. Join me, Lionel Nimrod, again next time for more journeys into this, my inexplicable world.
Nimrod's Inexplicable World was performed by Richard Herring, Stuart Lee, Armando Iannucci and Carla Mendonca, with Tom Baker as Lionel Nimrod. It was written by Stuart Lee and Richard Herring and produced from her evil undersea base by Sarah Smith.